Before we begin on our first case this morning, the first thing, if we could have a moment of silence for October 1 and the Harvest Festival shootings. Thank you. On this first case, the Nunnally v. Anthony and Sylvan Pool Corporation, Justice Perry Gary is disqualified with a conflict this morning, will not be participating. So the six-member court will handle this matter. Mr. Prince, for the appellants.
If it pleases the court, Chief Justice Douglas, NRS 11.202 is unconstitutional because it discriminates in two ways. First, it does not provide fair or adequate notice to a third-party personal injury plaintiff as to when the time period of the statute proposed, which basically abolishes the rights to any recovery against any contracting defendant or an owner. And secondly, because it unreasonably classifies and discriminates against a third-party personal injury
plaintiff. Mr. Prince, would we be taking a minority position as far as the other states that have viewed the statutes of repose in this rather than the majority position if we agree with you?
I think statute of repose have long been decided to be constitutional. However, this particular statute and the noticing provisions under this particular statute and how it classifies are unreasonable. For example, there's no reasonably calculated way to provide a third-party personal injury plaintiff notice of when substantial completion of a project occurs. It doesn't just occur simply with new construction. There could be modifications to an existing building, alterations, or a variety of other works of improvement for which there would be no indicator to a third-party personal injury plaintiff. On the other hand, as this court noted in Dykema, when you compare analyze NRS 11.2055, that is ambiguous. And this court determined in Dykema, as a result of that ambiguity, it's the notice of recordation of a notice of completion, which governs not simply the issuance, which is different than what the language of the statute provides for. Also in Dykema, this court noted that the legislative history, which is consistent throughout the history of all of the statutes proposed, the former 203, 204, and 205, all are predicated upon some type of notice. Here, there is no reasonably calculated notice to a third-party personal injury plaintiff. And what I mean by that is the legislative history is always talking about making it clear to the owner and to the contractor as to when the statute of repose starts to run. That is directly from this court's language in Dykema. In a third-party personal injury context, there may be no notification of any kind that provides any reasonable notice as to when the time period for the statute of repose starts to run. And that's critically important because the timing of when the statute starts to run and compliance, there's no other reasonable way for a third-party personal injury plaintiff to reasonably protect their rights. There needs to be some clear indication, the same as with a homeowner or any other project owner, as to when the time period starts to run for which you could sue for construction defect. Whether you want repairs made, whether there's injury to someone else's property, or alternatively, and in this particular case, a personal injury claim. This case illustrates the shortcomings of NRS 11.2055 read in connection with 11.202.
Mr. Prince, it appears as though the one-year extended filing deadline was intended to mitigate that issue.
That's correct.
Would like to hear from you and I assume Mr. Polsenberg is going to discuss this matter too for his side. Whether the legislature, in selecting a one-year extended filing deadline, overlooked the possibility that claims pending when the statute became effective would somehow be abrogated.
I think that the intent was to potentially abrogate those claims that might have even been pending at the time. I don't think the grace period is to resolve the constitutional problem this court previously had found in another case when there was retroactive application, but no grace period for which to timely file your action against a contracting defendant or even the owner. The problem that remains, though, is with substantial completion. There's no reasonably mechanism under the statute to inform a plaintiff like Mr. Donnelly, who is injured in a pool and has an incomplete quadriplegic, to know when the work, number one, started or when the work was completed. If you look carefully at NRS 11.2055, all those three indicators of when substantial completion has been achieved are all directed at the owner. So the owner has a clear understanding as to when the time period starts to run, so the owner can timely file a construction defect-related claim. All the legislative history, both before 2015 and during the 2015 session with AB 125, is all directed at homeowner-related claims against the contractor.
But wouldn't, in the homeowner context, if there was a subsequent homeowner that bought the house, and although the original homeowner may have known that when it was new, but the subsequent homeowner may not have known that, so wouldn't they still be bound by the statute of repose for a construction defect claim?
They would be.
Okay.
I think it would relate to both.
How's this different, though?
Well, you're talking about one is potentially a claim against the owner and the other is against the contracting defendants.
Okay.
So while one claim may or may not be barred just because of by reason of the status, if there's a new change in ownership, that person may or may not have been negligent in the design, construction, or even the oversight of construction. So there might be a completely separate defense as to that. But as it relates to contracting defendants, those parties now are going to potentially escape liability when there's no indication as to when the project was substantially complete. This case, while there is some vague record that we did not learn about until after the litigation commenced as an exhibit to this motion for summary judgment, we would have no reasonable way of knowing the final county inspection, and inspection, I don't know which one, the county or otherwise, occurred on October the 20th, 2004. There's no reasonable way for us to know that. As this court noted in Dykema, the better reasoned approach is to file some type of recording so that's recorded for the world to see when a project was completed. This court interpreted the language NRS 11.2055, one subpart B, as the issuance of a notice of completion to mean to require a recording. The statute does not require a contractor to record a notice of completion, only an issuance, which is a big distinction in our mind, which does substantially affect our client's rights as well as similarly situated client's rights. And as a result of that, if the classification is unfair and that there's not reasonable notice so that you can timely protect your legal rights, you've now lost a substantive right. And that is a fundamental interest, because now you have no right to sue any party, including now an owner, because an owner is also equally protected under the statute for the construction, design, and oversight of all three of those aspects. And so for those reasons, we think that the statute fails because it doesn't provide reasonable notice. For example, under Chapter 108 relating to mechanics lien statutes, the notice of substantial completion reported triggers a series of deadlines, including timely recording your lien and outlines the time period on which you have to file an action to enforce your lien. Think about how a court proceeding would work. It's not until you file a notice of entry of a judgment, and you give notice to all the parties in the case, that it triggers a number of deadlines: a time for filing a motion for a new trial, a time for filing an application for attorney's fees and costs, and more importantly, a time period for which to pay or file an appeal, which is jurisdictional. If you don't timely file the notice of appeal, there is no appellate rights. They're gone. So, and you can't even, for example, you can't even extend the time period under the rules to file a motion for a new trial. So the notice served upon the world or the relevant parties does serve a very important function. And it's not too much to ask contractors, people who are in this business, who also have rights under Chapter 108, to record a notice of completion, substantial completion, so that not just for their own lien rights, but for third parties, so they know the time period in which their rights may have started to run or may be foreclosed, so they can timely protect those rights. That's exactly what Christopher Donnelly was facing in this case. It wasn't until the motion for summary judgment was filed that anyone learned that there was some final, alleged, purported final inspection in October of 2004, 10 years before his injury in the pool that day. But also, the classification itself is unreasonable. Virtually all of the legislative history deals with and discusses the notice to an owner as the time period in which they need to file an action for construction defect. That's a significant legal disadvantage to someone who's a third-party personal injury plaintiff who has no relationship between the owner and the contracting defendants, has probably or may not have ever had any interaction with the property, and did not even discover that they even had any right or claim until potentially far after the statute of repose has expired. And if you compare the rights of a typical personal injury plaintiff, they have 2 years from the date of injury or damage in which to file suit. You cannot file suit until you have an injury or damage. And under the statutory scheme, those claims are going to be abolished, using the language of the court from State Farm, even before those rights arise. So it's a very sensitive topic.
Did the trial lawyers or the legislators do anything in legislative history to say that this is a problem that exists? Now, was that brought up at all by the trial lawyers or the government affairs people or any legislators?
Justice Sherry, my review of the minutes from the most recent session in 2015, AB 125, relating to AB 125, there was no testimony or commentary as to how this may affect a third-party personal injury plaintiff's rights. The focus was all on homeowner rights, controlling construction defect litigation, and the sweeping changes that were made legislatively to Chapter 40 and those particular claims.
So nobody said, don't worry about it because you can still sue the property owner. In other words, nobody said, we still have a remedy, the plaintiff would still have a remedy.
I think there was testimony and commentary that they saw the right to sue, which is true. There was never any discussion about how their rights would be affected by reason of the substantial completion notice. And this court has never addressed what is required for substantial completion and how the notice is to be received beyond what you decided in the Dykema case.
Mr. Frenchier, four minutes at this point, if you wish.
I'm going to reserve 2 minutes for the rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Prince, in 1983, there was discussion about how it would affect the unwary person who was injured by a construction defect. And the statute didn't change that dramatically between 83 and 2015 to merit an additional discussion on that point. Is that reading that correctly?
I don't think so. I think that there still needed to be a discussion on it. While there may have been some minor discussion, it didn't merit a discussion because there was substantial change in the time periods in 2015. It went from an 8 and a 10-year down to a 6-year, whether it's a patent defect, a latent defect, or a known defect. So there is a substantially shorter period of time that's going to be affecting not only owner's rights, but also a third-party personal injury plaintiff like Mr. Donnelly. And if you compare the statute of limitations for a typical personal injury plaintiff, they have 2 years in which to file their action. Here, a statute of repose potentially could have barred the claim, and you don't even reach the statute of limitations question. And so, but also, the different footing, the different classification is between a third-party personal injury plaintiff and an owner. An owner has 6 years, and they're given the property, they have control of the property, and they have the ability to discover defects and timely file their action. After the 6 years, now the owner has substantial protection and is immune from suit after 6 years if it relates to an injury caused by a construction defect, either during the course of design or the construction itself. And while the court in Davenport did carve out a very limited exception to quote-unquote maintenance-related claims or potentially failure to warn claims, those topics are often very intertwined with the original design and construction of a particular project. And so as between a third-party personal injury plaintiff and an owner who is also suing for construction defect, although the damage is different, they are unreasonably classified, and that's discrimination. And because of that, there is no constitutional deference that this court must give to this particular statute in the way it's drafted presently. And so for those reasons, we're asking you to declare the statute unconstitutional and allow the case to proceed forward.
Could I just ask one question? I know you want to reserve, and hopefully the chief will extend your time so that you can address this question. I'm going to ask it again.
Okay.
Is the grace period provided in this statute a problem where, as shown by the facts in this case, the grace period cuts off your client's ability to sue on its preserved claim sooner than it would otherwise have had the two-year statute existed?
So, yes, it does. It does operate as
that
a legal disadvantage.
That was the point I wanted to ask. So why? There seems to be some case law that suggests that if the great that first there is, it is necessary to have a grace period in order to assure the constitutional efficacy of the shortened statute of repose period. But as well, the second question I have, and I'm not sure there's much case law on that, where the grace period that's been selected is too short to cut off or preserve existing claims, does that influence or affect the constitutionality of the grace period?
It does, because as of the injury happened on August 2nd, 2014, at that point, my client's cause of action accrued because he had an injury or damage. He had a two-year statute of limitations as of August 2nd, 2014, in which to file his lawsuit against the owner and the construction defendants, in this case, Anthony Sylvan Pools. The problem with the grace period was it shortened that period of time substantially without any significant notification to people similarly situated by my client. That right had already vested by that point, and therefore that is now shortened. It wasn't that the claim hadn't arisen, it had arisen, and now they're actually shortening the time period from when the time it arose. And so for those reasons, it is a constitutional problem in this particular case because it cut off what was otherwise a vested right, which in order to timely file an action to protect his legal rights.
Mr. Prince, we'll give you 2 minutes. And Mr. Paulsenberg, we'll give you an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Justice Douglas. May it please the Court, Dan Paulsenberg for the respondent. I wasn't sure I was going to need this time frame, and when plaintiffs started out arguing, they had significantly narrowed their argument, and they've been narrowing their argument. It was very broad in the district court, a little more narrow in the opening brief, more narrow in the reply brief, and when Mr. Prince started arguing, he was very narrow. He had only two issues, two reasons why a statute of repose is unconstitutional to a third party claimant. But then Justice Hardesty raised the question about the grace period, and they doubled down on the grace period argument, and that's why I have this timeline here. The cause of action didn't vest at the time of the accident on August 20th, 2014. It was already barred by the existing statute of repose, or at most there were 2.5 months left on the statute of repose for known deficiencies. So there's a 6-year statute that runs in 2010, a 8-year statute, and that runs in 2012, and then the 10-year statute for known deficiencies, which I don't think applies here, but even if it did, it would have barred this claim before AB 125 was even passed in 2015. So I don't think this grace period is an issue, but even if it is an issue, I think it is an appropriate grace period. If there had been, remember the Allsense case, there was a construction that took place during the old, the 1965 statute of repose. And then this court declared that statute to be unconstitutional in 1983 in State Farm versus All Electric. The legislature reenacted it, but they didn't make it retroactive. And in all sense, this court said, no, you can't apply it to existing claims without a grace period. Now, we've cited the Nevada Lawyer article that says, apparently the legislature learned the lesson from all sense, and here they had a grace period. And 1 year is an adequate grace period. The amicus brief points out that a case from another jurisdiction about 1 year being an adequate grace period. And we've got the Nevada Lawyer article as well. So I don't think the grace period's the issue. They have an argument it's unconstitutional. They don't say any case for why it's an inadequate grace period. Instead, now they've refined their argument and they're just going, irrespective of the timeline, they're just going on a statute of repose cannot apply to a third-party plaintiff. And by third-party plaintiff, they mean a plaintiff who wasn't part of the construction contract. Well, that doesn't work. And the justification they give for that is two. One, it's a fundamental right. You can't cut off a claim before it even accrues. These are all the arguments always raised against statutes of repose. This court has repeatedly rejected those arguments. They cite cases from the 50s and some more recent, some even older, that talk about a statute of limitations can't cut off a claim before it even accrues. Well, this court has held that a statute of repose can do that. With their argument for it being unconstitutional on the third-party claim, they say a personal injury plaintiff who's not a party to the contract would have no way of knowing when substantial completion has occurred. So they won't know when the statute of repose is going to start to run. I have two answers for that. Back when I was a plaintiff's lawyer at Neil Gallitz's office, we'd know there was an accident. We didn't know who the insurance company was. We wouldn't know all the details in medical malpractice cases. You don't know what went on during surgery. That's what you have to find out. Nobody's going to come over and hand the information to you. And here, the information is a matter of public record. NRS 11.2055. says that you can determine substantial completion in three ways. It's when the notice of completion is issued, and if it's recorded, when it's recorded, when the final inspection takes place, or when the certificate of occupancy is issued. Now, the notice of completion is a private document. It's something a landowner does to contractors and subcontractors to get the mechanics lien statute 90 days running. And so that has to be recorded to become a public document. And this court said that the recordation is what starts to run. But the other two documents are already public records. And that's what was attached on page 26 of the appendix. Now, plaintiff comes in and says, well, you know, that's some kind of private document and we didn't have access to it. No, that's a county document. This house was in the county. And it's so easy to look this up. In fact, last week I called the building department and I said, how do you look this up? And they gave me the permit number, which is also on page 26 of the appendix. They told me what web page to go to, and I went to it. It's the exact same material that's on page 26 of the appendix, including the final inspection of the pool being approved. So again, they're on notice of when this takes place, and so they are in a situation that is not constitutionally improper and different from similarly situated people. Now, so they are on notice, and that's what starts it to run. Justice Gibbons, you asked about the subsequent owner. Yes, there in the Ellie case, Ellie versus Stevens, it was a case where one person had built the house as the owner, sold it to another one in 1973, who sold it to somebody else in 1985. That person was injured and sued the original person. And this court talked about retroactive application and all the different versions, but never said, no, it simply doesn't apply to a third party to the construction contract. They try to distinguish the cases. You know, their opening brief, issue one on page two, was it doesn't apply to his personal injury case. Which is why I spent a lot of time, including in footnote 6 in the answering brief, saying, look at all the times this court has applied the statutes of repose in personal injury. And they come back and say, well, those are all distinguishable because it's not a third-party situation. In Ellie, they say, well, that was the subsequent buyer in 73, so he knew when the construction took place. Well, no. It was the buyer in 85. They're trying to find ways to distinguish all these cases. Wise versus Bechtel, where the employees at the power plant were scolded by the burning steam. They say, well, they were employees, so maybe they could have figured out when the construction was completed. They've tried to find ways to distinguish this court's cases, and in fact, they can't. Because they also had a way to figure out when the statute of repose started to run. Justice Terry, you asked whether if we went this way, it would be the minority view. I don't know of any case that draws a distinction, and they don't say it any, about a third-party plaintiff as opposed to a tenant or a subsequent purchaser. There aren't any cases. And as for whether this is a fundamental right, yes. We would be in the vast minority, and in fact, the cases we would be joining are old cases from the middle of the last century. You also asked Justice Terry about NTLA. NTLA did not raise anything in 2015 when we were talking about adopting AB 125. They didn't say, no, this should be different. What about personal injury plaintiffs? Where they did raise the issue, as the amicus brief points out, was Bob Perry raised it for the NTLA in 1983 and said we should exempt out personal injury plaintiffs. And the legislature obviously rejected that. So this is a case, I think, where, yes, it's a statute of repose. And yes, looking at the timeline, this cause of action was abrogated before it even accrued. But if somehow AB 125 does apply to this, they still had, in addition, remember, they had more than a year because the accident was in August of 2014. AB 125 wasn't passed till February of 2015. And then they had a year after that. So they say no case about a one-year statute of repose being inadequate. They say no case about a third-party plaintiff being a distinction that violates equal protection. Their arguments, basically, are arguments this court has heard over and over again and rejected. And for these reasons, this court should affirm.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, of the court, Chief Justice Douglas. The difficulty with the analysis by the Anthony Sylvan Pools is the grace period shortened the already established statute of limitations by 6 months, all predicated upon the adequacy of the notice of substantial completion. The only way that NRS 11.202 is even triggered is if there's substantial completion. And there's no adequate notice to anyone, including a third party like my client, Christopher Donnelly, who is now paying the price for this, who is an incomplete quadriplegic. The final county inspection record, which is in the appendix as page 26, there is no indication, a clear indication, as to what work that applies to. And you're assuming that someone would have the level of sophistication, even if they're unrepresented, because we need to address it for all citizens, how would they go on the county's website, figure out what permit it applied to, what the scope of work was, what the permit necessarily even applied to. There could be a variety of different works on a project. Think about a large commercial context, not just an individual home. There may be 50 permits because there was a lot of work done over a period of years, which would be a very difficult task indeed. Requiring more clarity at a higher level so that people can timely protect their rights is critical. Because these rights are very time sensitive when you're dealing with statutes of repose, and they're penalizing. Because the suggestion is you don't have a valid claim. These people are now immune from suit. So if we're going to have a statute of repose, we need to build in the safeguards and the protections reasonably necessary so that individuals like my client, Christopher Donnelly, can timely protect their rights. Under the defendant's analysis, the 8-year statute of limitation would have potentially been only applicable. As a latent defect. That means this thing was over in 2012. How would Christopher Donnelly even know that it would have been over? Nobody would have known because there's no notice of completion recorded, which is if a construction defendant wants to limit their liability, that's not an unreasonable requirement to have them record or provide some type of adequate notice. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank counsel for their arguments. As they ask this interesting issue, this matter will be submitted.